Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Future Ready webinar. I am Dr. Avril Smart-Goggins, Research and Engagement Manager for Future Ready Schools. Future Ready is a project at the Alliance for Excellent Education in Washington, D.C., where our work, in partnership with 60 other partner organizations, focuses on increasing leadership capacity among school and district leaders to maximize digital learning and move quickly towards student-centered learning. Since 2014, Future Ready Schools has provided districts with the tools and resources that they need to ensure that local technology and digital learning plans align with instructional best practices and are implemented by highly qualified and highly trained teachers. This work could not be possible without educators like you who have engaged in our programming offerings from institutes to workshops to online professional learning, and use that information to improve and make steps for change in your environment. So thank you for that, and thank you for joining us today for our discussion on building strong school-to-community partnerships to support student-centered learning. With me today are Dr. Anthony Jackson, Superintendent of Vance County Schools in North Carolina, and Michael Abensor, Executive Director of the Cramden Institute, a nonprofit organization in North Carolina that works to collect and distribute refurbished technology to deserving students across the state. It's my pleasure to be with both of you today, and thank you so much for joining. I'm excited to get started, but I want to start off with introductions. So Dr. Jackson, if you don't mind, can you start us off by telling us a little bit about your school district and the work that you've done thus far to implement student-centered learning?
First of all, thank you all for having me, and I'm always pleased to represent the Vance County School System. We are a rural school system with lots of urban influences, if you will, of 6,000 students. We're located about 45 minutes north of the Research Triangle Park. We, as I said, 6,000 students, about 1,200 employees. We are considered a high poverty district. 90% of our students are qualified for free and reduced meals. We have made huge performance strides over the past 6 years. 6 years ago, we were designated a low-performing district. We're no longer a low-performing district, meaning at the time I arrived there 6 years ago, 11 of our 17 schools were designated low-performing. This year, we have two of those schools that are just about out of that designation, so the vast majority of our schools are no longer low-performing. We've embraced a mantle around being an incubator for innovation. We've implemented large-scale reform to push the agenda around student-centered learning and project-based learning and individualized and personalized learning. And some of those would include opportunity culture. We've implemented a full-scale digital initiative where we've moved, and this year it's lined up perfectly with the crisis has been an opportunity for us because we were ready to launch our one-to-one initiative this year, year-round schools, STEM school, early college. Our schools, we are the largest deployment of ZSpace, virtual intelligence technology in the Southeast. And so those are some of the things that we've done around the work, around trying to give kids opportunities that would open doors for them to access the region and to take advantage of future opportunities. And most important for us, and the thing we're proudest of, is 6 years ago, we had the absolute lowest graduation rate in the state of North Carolina. We were at 66%. I'm pleased to report that last year, and then this year it'll be even higher, but last year we exceeded the state graduation rate. We were 89.6 last year, we've grown steadily over the past 6 years, and we're really proud of that, which meant that our students, with one of the things we're proudest about is their access to opportunities to continue their education. So we've gone from about $3 million in scholarship for those students who graduate Vance County to nearly $12 million this year. So we're excited about that. So.
Congratulations. And thank you so much for giving us that great overview. I want to move on to ask Michael to do something similar and introduce the audience to the Cramden Institute and your focus on supporting students outside of school.
Thank you for having me and for presenting the Cramden Institute. Cramden's been around since 2003. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and our mission is pretty simple. It's providing technology tools and training to bridge the digital divide. And what that realistically means is that for the first 10 or so years of Crandon's Institute, we were a nonprofit computer refurbisher, and we still refurbish quite a bit of computer material. It's materials that's donated to us from companies, corporations, Fortune 50 companies, individuals, municipalities, cities, etc. We turn those computers around, refurbish them here in a warehouse, and put them directly into the hands of students who do not have a computer at home. It also go out to low-income communities, they go to other nonprofits. And we do this because we've realized over the years that having a device, and having connectivity, and having the knowledge of how to use that is critical. It's essential. You cannot function in today's society without having those tools. And annually, we probably do somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 computers that go into the community across the state. We also train up to 1,500 people a year. And a lot of these statements I always put in parentheses, PC, pre-COVID. After COVID, we're still trying to figure a way forward. But just to give you an indication of the need out there, we were about to shut down operations, and we had a few days before we kind of went into temporary hibernation. We put just a simple Facebook post that said, hey, if you have a student in the Triangle and you need a computer, let us know. We have some computers ready to go out there. We received over 5,000 phone calls within the next 24 hours. Our phones were flooded. And again, it just gives you an indication of the incredible need out there for technology device, technology instruction. And it's not just for a student, it's for the whole family, right? And we've all seen it, and this is a great example of this. If you don't have a computer and you don't have an internet connection, you don't have knowledge on how to use those tools, you're not going to be able to do your work remotely. You're not going to have access to those opportunities in the first place. So our entire work is making sure that students and their families have everything they need so that they can connect in a 21st century society and to academically perform well and for their workforce to perform well.
Thank you. And we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the challenges that remote learning has surfaced related to access and opportunity for students outside of school to extend their learning. But before we get into those questions, I want to start off by talking about the role of school-to-community partnerships in the context of student-centered learning and provide a little bit of background on the ways that those relationships can be mutually beneficial. So both the family and the community are partners with the school in children's education and development. We know that. They have shared interests in and responsibility for children, and they work together to create better programs and opportunities for students to learn and grow. A few of the benefits of that relationship include improved school programs and school climate, family services and support being provided in and outside of school, and an increase in parent skills and leadership. These networks create a united front around high quality education for all students, and they really do help teachers to better connect the lived experiences of their students with what they learn in the classroom. So when parents, teachers, and students and others partner together in supporting students' education, a caring community forms, and students and their futures are better for it. So with that said, Dr. Jackson, I wanna ask you about what does a healthy school to community partnership actually look like? And what role has partnering with families and local organizations played in your district in terms of programming and in terms of providing better student support?
Well, first of all, I agree wholeheartedly with the prior statement, but I would say that those partnerships can't work if they're not integrally connected with all of those stakeholder groups you mentioned. Parents have to be a part of that. Community has to be a part of that, and those larger partners, whether they're community or business partners, have to be engaged in that work. So the first thing I would say is that those partnerships have to be mutually beneficial. And I think for a long time, we've asked agencies and organizations to come and support us and to say to us that we're gonna do something for the schools. And I think the relationships have to be mutually beneficial for both the schools and the organization. What are they getting out of this as well as what are we getting out of this? Okay. The second piece of that is they have to be mission aligned. I really don't want a partner that's not aligned with the mission of our organization. Nothing that you can bring to me is that important that it's going to be contrary to the work that we're doing every day to change the lives of kids. It needs to be outcomes driven. what are we doing and why are we doing it? It has to line up with our why, so that if ultimately we're preparing kids to be able to embrace the things that are happening. One of my big passions is I believe our kids, because they live so close to the Research Triangle Park, they should be able to access the work and see that as a viable option for them in the future. So for me, the biotech world and things like that, what are they going to get out of it? So the outcome has to be that they have some level of exposure to that, to the opportunities that exist over there and in their region. And then they have to, it has to be embraced and understood by both the internal and external folk that this is a mutual partnership. It can't be, oh, those poor kids, we're doing this for them. And right. It can't be, oh, we're going to take advantage of what they have. This is a toy store, a toy store for us to get stuff, because I think we've had enough stuff. We need to cut, we need to translate that stuff. And then finally, I think it needs to, every partnership, I tell my staff this, every partnership has to be a catalyst for other partnerships. So we want those partnerships to be so well done and so connected to our work that others will see that and be able to find where they can plug in as well. So those are that's kind of the formula that we use in Vance County Schools to evaluate who we partner with and how we partner with them, because it always starts with why we're going to partner with them.
Absolutely. And I know, Michael, you share some of those points, but I want you to answer that question from your perspective as a nonprofit executive director. Why is it important for Cramden to create and sustain relationships with schools and districts in the state? And then how do you begin to develop those partnerships? What are the steps that you take as an organization to get those things going?
Everything Dr. Jackson said is 100% on the nose. It has to be mutually advantageous for both parties, both organizations. It has to be mission-driven. I agree with every point you made. The points I would add to it are also, there has to be buy-in and leadership from both levels, both organizations. We've had countless partnerships with lots of different school districts and individual schools. And the success or failure of those partnerships inevitably starts and begins with leadership buy-in. If I don't see that on my counterpart or vice versa, the partnership just doesn't work. You have to have clear goals, clear metrics as to what this is going to look like, and not just in 6 months, but in a year, but also how is this going to evolve as the needs of the partnership evolve. We've partnered with certain school districts where the moment the superintendent left, and in North Carolina, it's very common for superintendents to switch districts, the entire partnership fell apart. And it was kind of sad, because at the end of the day, the folks that lose out the most on this are the kids, right? You know, we're all trying to do the same thing. We're trying to come in. We're trying to help in any way we can. One of the things we always keep in the back of our minds as well is that schools are inundated, absolutely inundated with requests for partnerships, with salespeople, with, you know, all sorts of different activities. What I don't want to do is I don't want to create extra work for a teacher or a principal or a superintendent. That's not my purpose. I want to figure out a way that we can work together in a way that's efficient, that makes sense, and that's scalable ultimately. You know, North Carolina's got 100 some, the exact number of school districts, usually one per county, some counties have a couple of them. You know, I'm always looking to a partnership with a specific district with the eye to see if this can be replicated across regionally, multi-counties, multi-districts. So if that work is scalable from the get-go, that to me is interesting. That's something we can work on and really have a large impact. Because some school districts are very small, and that's great. It's great to work with small school districts because you can really pilot some interesting things. But I want to see if something I do in Edgecombe County works in Mecklenburg County or in Wayne County, you know, where the districts are enormous. And the challenges are also completely different. You know, in North Carolina, the rural versus urban divide is enormous. It's probably one of the greatest in any of the states on the Atlantic. And just because something works in one county doesn't mean it's going to work in the other. So there has to be a certain amount of flexibility there in order to advance the goals that we both share.
And so you both touched on the importance of your partnership being driven by the same goal and the same mission. But I want to push back to both of you a little bit to give us some examples of how do you begin to develop partnerships with local organizations, with parents, et cetera. What's some of the first steps that you take from your perspective, Michael, as an organization, but from your perspective, Dr. Jackson, what are some of the steps that you take to begin to either pursue a partner or to create the partnership? And I'll let you go first, Dr. Jackson.
Well, the first thing we we try to do is find synergy around the problem. So to me, partnerships are about solving a problem. And so if my problem really is lack of access to resources, then I want to find a partner who's skilled at connecting me to resources.
Right.
I don't need to find a partner who's skilled at identifying that that the problem is lack of resources. I want somebody who can help me say, here's where it is. And then there's a collective acceptance of a strategy to solve the problem. So in one district, we worked with a partner because we recognized that we had a lack of capacity in our teacher skill base around digital learning, around blended learning in classrooms. Our teachers wanted to do it, but they really just lacked the real pedagogy to get it done. They were willing. And so we pursued and built a partnership with the Friday Institute to make that happen in that district. In another district, we had a leadership challenge. And in another district, we really had to come and we sit down and really process out a real strategy to solve the problem. And then there has to be a willingness on to bring the best of both entities to bear. So I want to bring my best teachers and align them with your strategy. And hopefully the outcome is going to be something magical for kids. And so that's how we look at it. I don't just want a partner just because you're located in my locality. Right. I really want that conversation to be around solving whatever the big rocks are for our kids. Right now with COVID, everybody is saying they can solve my problem. Not true. I'm really looking for those real partners. Well, first of all, I'm pleased that we have some long-term sustained partners who have been great partners, because for me, if you can't be a good thought partner, I know you're not going to be a good execution partner. So I like to sit down and really problem solve that way first. And once I see that you have a real strategy for attacking problems, addressing problems, and digging in and building long-term sustainable strategies for that, then I know we can solve any problem together. So those are kind of the three things that we look for. I don't know, Mike, if you would agree with those kinds of things. So.
Yeah, I agree with everything. You know, it's again, I always keep in the back of my mind whenever we approach a school district or a school in particular. I look at the leadership. I look at what challenge they want to solve. And I want to look if it's reasonable, right? That's the other thing. You know, especially for nonprofits, we have very finite resources, and we have very finite funds, and we have finite staff. You know, we try to always stretch above our means, but we have to be careful, because I want to make sure that the partnership is sustainable over the long term. One of the things I cannot stand is a drop in, get out partnership. That doesn't make sense to me. At that point, you're just a service provider. You know, I want to make sure it's a relationship, and I want to make sure that the relationship evolves and the project evolves, and that we know how to work together in a way that makes sense, right? And again, we try to stay within our lane. We know what our mission is. We know what we're good at, right? We know that intrinsically we are very good at a few things, and that's what we want to be. We don't want to be good at, you know, okay at a lot of things. We want to be very good at a very few specific things. And that oftentimes means that, you know, we pass on lots of projects or partnerships because not within our wheelhouse, or we're not sure we can execute to the level we're used to. And if we can't do that, we're just going to pass.
Awesome. And you guys touch on some really good points. I like the way that Dr. Jackson, you staggered it first from developing a problem that you all share and that you're both willing to work towards solving. And I like Michael's addition of making sure it makes sense for your organization, right? So not attempting to solve a problem that you know that your organization is not equipped to solve. And those are both really important points. I want to talk a little bit about remote learning, and we touched on this a little bit when Dr. Jackson, you mentioned COVID. Not unlike other states, North Carolina went under a shelter-in-place order in March. And as a result, we know that schools and districts are disrupted, and they had to immediately transition to remote learning. So our new normal has resurfaced challenges for students all over the place related to access, related to opportunity, and all other challenges basically aligned with extending their learning beyond the school day and beyond those four walls of the school. I want to talk about how your existing partnerships have served each of you to helping address those remote learning challenges during this time. Starting with Dr. Jackson, how do you call on your community to support student learning during school closures? What are the ways that you've leveraged your partnerships so far, and what are the ways that you're thinking about carrying forward those partnerships in the future to continue some of the work you're doing now?
So, first of all, I'm going to say I think we were uniquely positioned in Vance County because we had started this conversation about anytime, anywhere learning 3-4 years ago, and so we had begun to build partnerships with foundations and philanthropic groups around training and supporting the professional development of teachers, so that while we had kids, we were trying to look at how can we provide blended learning for kids? How can we extend learning beyond the schoolhouse and provide opportunities for kids to learn at home, anytime, anywhere, using every tool at their disposal? In our community, we had begun the conversations around extending broadband and making sure that it's available. If I have to drop a parenthetical something right here, it would be that to me is the biggest challenge that we're having.
Absolutely.
It's not going to be devices. While I believe that the device issue can be solved, that's a manufacturing issue. The broadband issue is a wills issue. It's a moral issue to me, and it's much like water and electricity and one of those things. We've got to begin to see that as a requirement for anything we build, a requirement for any part of our community, that broadband is as essential to a family and to a student and to our existence as water and electricity are to a home. So that's kind of my soapbox over there. But I would say to you that once we have done that, we had thought partners around that work, we were already uniquely positioned to do some of those things. And then we realized that we had to have a strategy that encompassed all of that, understanding that we had some kids who were on a spectrum for remote learning that would say that they could have access to a device and broadband all day long, all the way to kids who had nothing. And so we had to develop a strategy and a framework that would support that. And so we were, again, working with our support partners to do that, so that we had the ability to provide every student with a device, but we also had the ability to provide students with a device with the resources on the device, as well as a hotspot, as well as those things. So we have partners already lined up. Friday Institute was one of those partners. We have Lenovo as a partner with us on devices. We have we were one of the state offered the opportunity for us to engage in putting hotspots on buses and putting them in remote parts of our community. And we, as I said earlier, we've been considered one of those incubators for innovation. So people know that as a district, we are good implementers and good finishers in those kind of pilot projects. Our issues is going to be the sustainability and keeping those things going, because we're very good at it. But because of the resources available to our community, we don't have the resources to sustain beyond when those grants and things run out. So those are some of the things. Those partners have been very upfront with us. They've been honest, much like Michael indicated, around saying what they can do and can't do. So we've had to cobble all of them together to build a collaborative strategy. And the good news is that because all of our partners are mission-driven, and align with the work that we've been doing, it's been very easy to connect them on our behalf, because they all recognize what we're doing. So I think we've been able to do it seamlessly, but I believe the huge challenges are out there. And the one thing, and again, I'll stop after this, is that I believe the challenges in the larger districts and the challenges in the smaller districts are equal. I think some of the smaller districts were able to make the shift a lot easier,
right?
Some of the large, because of scale, that's one thing. But also, I think because we never we've been talking about digital learning and remote learning and personalized learning forever, but our first time, our first big stress test, and quite frankly, I think we failed. We weren't ready, and so mm-hmm. now we have to think it through and do some things differently. But our partners made the work a lot easier for us.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think this process, this school closures and shelter in place has really been a stress test for a lot of districts, and they are quickly making adjustments and definitely learning along the way. And it'll be a test as to how much we've learned when school reopens and how we change and transition the way that the business of school, I'll say. Michael, in a similar way, I want to talk about from a nonprofit organization, how has shelter in place adjusted the way you function as an organization, and what did you do? What are the differences in the way that you operate now as opposed to prior to shelter in place?
It's probably a shorter list to talk about of things that haven't changed. All right. It's been topsy-turvy. I mean, there's no question about it, right? And we're not alone, obviously. Everybody's in the same boat trying to work against the current. But for us, you know, we're a small nonprofit. We have 10 full-time staff. We had a couple of part-time staffers as well. But the most important part for our operations, and what is really the heart and soul of Cramden, is our volunteer base. 2,000 volunteers that come through our doors every year, as well as countless corporate donors and supporters that we do corporate events with. Those are tens of thousands of man hours to refurbish, to help, the logistics and the processes, and that's evaporating. So we've been very careful about, doing a very staggered reopening on our schedule, not the state's, not anybody else's. We're doing our schedule. But we understand that, at the same time, our mission has never been as much in need in this current context as, we've ever seen, which is kind of a shame, because we've been talking about the home workout, we've been talking about digital divide for decades, and everybody's like, yeah, sure, we'll get to it eventually, but it was low on the list of priorities. And what COVID did more than anything else is rip that illusion right off, right? Because all of a sudden there's 1.5 million students in North Carolina, and all of a sudden they're all learning from home, they're all remote learning. And then at that point, you started getting inundated with requests for devices, requests for partnerships, requests for, well, who works here? What ISP works in this area, or what ISP works in that area? So it's, unfortunately, our work has never been more important, but it's also never been harder for us to fulfill as an organization. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to reopen, and we're trying to keep an eye for the future, because it's a lot of the things we're seeing, and Dr. Jackson was 100% right. There's a lot of grants right now. There's a lot of support. There's a lot of corporate involvement with our communities and our districts. I am very curious to see what happens when that goes back, when we go back to normal. I'm, kind of a pessimist on this. I think a lot of it's going to evaporate. I think a lot of the efforts we're doing right now, as much as I'd love to see them sustainable for the long term, I think they're going away. And I'll stay in my wheelhouse of expertise, which is devices. And it's fantastic that the state spend $35 million of federal money to put as many devices into the hands of students across the state as possible. I know for, Durham County, for example, just adopted a one-to-one program for the first time in its history, which is great. But, I remember 2008, I remember 2009, I remember VTOP money when it came down, and it was a giant pile of cash that everybody jumped onto, and substantially more money too, just in terms of digital inclusion work and broadband availability and device availability. The problem with that pile of money is that the next year it wasn't there anymore. So what are these schools going to do to sustain this, right? To sustain Wi-Fis in buses or hotspots for students to take home, or devices they can take to school and bring home as well. Because sooner or later that resource is going to run out, and they're going to have to figure out ways to include this in the budget. And by all indications, budgets are going to get slashed, so it's going to be really tough. And again, we're going to be called on as a nonprofit, as all nonprofits are, to really help out in what is going to be a period of fiscal austerity, in my mind, at least for the next couple of years in North Carolina. So it's going to be a very difficult environment moving forward. And again, it's the flying the ordnance speech, I hate to say, but it's the perspective I have from seeing this play out in years past. And I'm sure Dr. Jackson has seen this as well. So I'm just curious to hear his thoughts on this.
Well, I honestly believe that there's going to be, we're going to have to be very, very astute in how we use the flood of dollars right now and play long game. I've made it clear to my staff, I love the money we're getting now, but we want to invest in people, processes, and products, so that long term the impact will outlast the dollars. We've got to be able 5 years from now to look back and say, this is what we did with those dollars, that they are in fact still at work. So we've got to invest in the pedagogy. We've got to invest in processes to get to answers. We've got to invest in the right products that will last longer. I think people are talking a lot about digital resources. My biggest concern, again, I'm not so much worried about devices. I don't think we're talking enough about connectivity, and I don't think we're talking enough about digital resources, the actual content that actually goes in the classrooms, and how we're going to upfit our teachers with the skills to shift from what they know, what they do every single day, to align to an individualized learning plan for every single child using those instructional resources. I just don't think we're talking enough about that. And quite frankly, I don't think we've made the investment over time. And I think that's gonna be the next hill we're gonna run into. Right now, the hill we're into is connectivity and actual devices. I just again, so I've also often said, if we're not in education thinking like the medical profession, I continue to say we should have a digital device stockpile, much like they had for ventilators and things like that. We should not get caught ever again not having enough devices for kids. That's shameful to me. We know how many kids we have, and we know what it would take. Hospitals model every single year. What if we had this catastrophe happen and we had this happen, these are the number of cases that would hit an emergency room. And you saw they were able to get a ship and move it to the coast because they anticipated what that model said. We are not that nimble. It takes too many committees for us to get there.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'll use this opportunity to talk about Future Ready Schools framework. One of the components of obviously our discussion is community partnerships, and that's one of the gears in the framework. But we also talk about robust infrastructure, curriculum, instruction and assessment, personalized professional learning, to your point, Dr. Jackson. So there are multiple components of what makes an efficient and effective digital learning transition. And while in this moment we are thinking about the boxes and wires and the devices, there are other essential components that will make sure that our efforts are sustainable. And so we strongly advocate for districts to use this time to plan, as difficult as it seems, given, you know, we're in kind of emergency mode right now, survival mode, if you will. We should also take a pause to think about what can this look like in the future and how can we start building our strengths in other areas in order to be prepared for what comes next. So you both make a great point there. I want to transition a little bit. Dr. Jackson, you mentioned a few times that your district ascribes to an opportunity culture. And I want to take a moment just to have you describe for the audience, what is opportunity culture and how does it guide your work as a superintendent in your county, in Vance County?
And so opportunity culture is a framework that's designed to ensure that every single child has access to your best prepared teachers, to a high quality teacher, no matter what. And as I told you, Vance County is a rural district outside two very high performing highly resourced districts. We sit in probably the most competitive area for teachers in North Carolina. I compete with Raleigh, Wake County, Durham, Chapel Hill for teachers. And so it makes it very difficult when they can pay teachers in terms of local supplement 3, 4, sometimes 5 times what we're able to pay them in supplement. And so it means that there's a constant churn and transition of teachers outside of my classrooms going to those districts when opportunities present themselves. We recognize that that's a part of the work, but we wanted to find ways to keep our best teachers in our classrooms. And what we found was the only real nugget we had to offer was to promote them, I don't ever call it up, but to promote them out into an administrative role. And so that was the only pathway out. And to be, if you're a teacher, if you really wanted to provide for your family and make additional resource money and compensation, the only way to do that was to leave your classroom. Well, we decided 5 years ago that we were going to change that trajectory and say that we were going to honor the work that happens in the classroom and honor the work of our most effective teachers by incentivizing them staying in the classroom. And so we began to utilize the structure, it's called Opportunity Culture, and we partnered with a group called Public Impact, where we began to provide strategic training for those teachers around coaching other teachers. So the way it works is we extend the reach of those teachers who have data that would indicate they are effective with kids. So our teachers who have exceeded growth with kids, they are eligible to be what we call multi-classroom leaders and or extended reach teachers, meaning they're willing to intentionally to say to me, I will teach more kids and I'm going to benefit because they are effective teachers. And so they're going to touch more kids. And for that, we're going to pay you. You don't have to become an assistant principal or principal. We want you to be a coach and a model for other teachers to help other teachers extend your knowledge to those teachers and not be an administrator. So we've implemented that in our buildings in 11 of our 15 schools, and they are Opportunity Culture schools, and we hope to come to scale this year. We continue to provide them real support through, again, that was a strategic partnership to help us solve that problem. And so with Public Impact, and then on top of that, the new leaders training for the principals to understand that they can't use these people as administrators. They have to then embrace a coaching model and a philosophy to do that. And so as a result of that, we don't have conversations in Vance County about class size anymore. We don't have, because we have an extended reach teacher who says, I'll teach 30% more kids on purpose. Give them, they ask for them, but we compensate them. They can make 20, 30, 40% more. On top of that, doing what they came into this work to do, and that was to teach kids, and they've proven to be effective doing that. And so we do that. So it was a partnership to solve a problem. We did. It builds internal capacity for us. It extends the reach of good teachers. It provides professional development for those teachers, and it's helped us keep those excellent teachers employed and staying in Vance County. In fact, we have people who have left the principalship in other districts to come and be multi-classroom leaders or extended reach teachers, because that's why we all came into the profession, to teach and impact children. So it's been a win for us.
Right. And so, Michael, in our previous conversation, we talked about a similar kind of opportunity culture that Cramden has adopted by extending your programming beyond distributing refurbished computers. So tell us a little bit about the types of programs that you offer beyond the distribution piece.
Yeah, and COVID has kind of upended a lot of these programs, obviously. So what we're trying to do right now is convert as many of our in-person classes, after-school workshops, into online workshops. And that's going fairly well, but it is, in my mind, you're still missing something when you don't have somebody physically in our classroom with instructors and whatnot. One of my favorite programs that we used to do, and we will do again, and then we're trying to figure out how to convert online, it's called Tech Trailblazers. And that's taking a resource we already have, which is a warehouse, and trying to figure out a different use for it. Now, a warehouse doesn't sound too exciting. It's a factory line, in essence, for refurbished devices. But we found out from a lot of students and teachers and parents that, a lot of schools don't offer the sort of deep dive inside a computer, what are these parts for, programming, and considering that we're in the triangle, and that we are surrounded by a constellation of tech companies who cannot find enough bodies to fill the jobs they have, we said this would be a great way to excite middle schools, particularly, though we do some high school, but middle school students, that crossroads educationally, where they're going to start thinking about the future once they're in the high school. So we created a program where they would come into Cramden in our classroom, we have a couple of classrooms here, to learn about a computer and the parts and the software, and that's exciting, but then we transition into the warehouse where they actually put their hands on these parts, thousands of them, right? It's a geek paradise back there, and I say that endearingly. And they take several classes to learn about different components of computers, different programs, how they run on a computer, how all the parts talk together. The most interesting aspect is the capstone at the end of this is that they take all that knowledge and all that learning that have taken over several different sessions, and they will build their own computer from parts and take that home with them. And it's a fantastic program. So schools love it because we offer something that they would love to offer, but just don't have the exact resources that we do. We love it because we're providing schools of service. We take low-income kids who have been told their entire life, don't tear that apart, don't break it, you know, don't mess with it. We want them to do those things. And we hope it activates in them an excitement for a possible career in a tech field. And, you know, in some of these classes, we'll bring in speakers from tech companies. And they're not shy. They'll ask, how much do you make? How did you get there? They want to know the concrete steps. And so for us, it checks a lot of boxes. But again, right now, we're just trying to figure out how we can extend our current programming further away from in-person, just in response to COVID and the pandemic. You know, I'm pretty optimistic eventually we'll get back to normal. But in the back of our mind, our programs need to serve a cause. And that cause is not simply, here's a computer, here's this. We want them to use it as a tool for either in their career or for their career or for their schoolwork and their academic performance. So that's kind of informs all the things we do here at Crandon.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that, Michael. And I want to use this opportunity to pause and remind our audience to follow the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #FutureReady. We want to encourage you to keep asking questions and learning from each other about this topic. And I just want to take a moment to get you to do that so that we can keep the conversation going. Continuing along that same note, I want to talk a little bit about Dr. Jackson, about community partnerships and how they benefit teachers and school level administrators to provide wraparound services. And so during this time, we know that in addition to COVID, there are a lot of other social justice crises happening in our nation and in our communities that are affecting students' social and emotional learning and their abilities to cope and their abilities to manage their environments in this time, in addition to trying to engage in learning outside of school. So I want to ask you, what partnerships, if any, do you have in place to support students' social and emotional needs? And then what are some ways that school districts can generate partnerships around psychological support and well-being support for teachers and students outside of school?
And so these are trying times for our kids. COVID had presented a huge challenge, and then a lot of the social unrest right now in our country, I think, is creating challenges not only for our kids, but for our adults. So we're trying to work to make sure that, one, our kids remain connected. I am concerned about the disconnection of kids, and I'm also concerned about the disconnection that's happening around the adults. Because I think while we have a school behavior health team that we have maintained throughout this entire process, they meet pretty much daily. We've created a process for our kids to check in, for our adults to check on the kids, for our community resources that were in place, our community-based agencies that support us, we have what's called JCPC, our juvenile council for the prevention of crime. We work with them. We're working with our faith-based groups. And I honestly want to throw the challenge out to our faith-based communities. I know that our churches are not meeting, but you could help us meet the need through a lot of tele-support, through a lot of digital support, through just like we're doing now. We've got to become more comfortable just checking in. And just asking the question, how are you doing? Not that we're going to provide any service, but I think one of the greatest things that we can do right now is extend ourselves to one another and just ask how you're doing, because this is unprecedented for most of us. And I think a lot of people, I'm concerned about my staff as much as I am my students, that we have a lot of adults who are suffering in silence. They're facing, we have unprecedented job loss. We have unprecedented, those are adult issues. And here's what I know. Everybody keeps talking about coming back to normal and getting back to normal. Back to normal is not going to be normal. And when we get back, we're going to have to provide as much support, I'm afraid, for the adults to address return from the trauma than we are, or as much as we are for kids. I have adults who have lost family members to the virus. I have kids who've lost family members to the virus. And so we're really having to have different conversations about what social and emotional support looks like in schools. And it can no longer be a counselor in every building. It's more than that. I think we're going to have resources that are available after hours. We're going to have resources that people can tap into confidentially, because pride is still very high. We don't want people to know when we're weak. We don't want people to know when we are not at our best. And so we have to find ways and avenues for them to do that. I think we're going to have find ways for kids to, even our youngest, to be able to tell us, I'm hurting and I don't know why I hurt. Because, you know, before, if somebody was mean to me, yeah, I know they're mean, but right now I'm feeling bad and I don't know why. And so I think we're going to have to figure out ways to support them through that. I'm a big proponent for telecounseling. I think we're going to have to be more flexible with the use of state resources. I'll take that opportunity to plug that. We've got to find ways to soften the same rules that we made and say that we've got to, just like we're going to have to change the way we educate kids every day, I think we're going to have to change the way that we provide support for them and change the way we provide support for our adults. And by meaning that we're going to have to use the resources out there. Why that's important for me in Vance County is, again, I'm a rural county outside major metropolitan areas. I can barely find counselors and psychologists and social workers now. So I have to be able to use my resources to maybe do telecounseling and telemedicine in those regards, or my kids will be further isolated. And then the last group I want us to really remember is that we have a high number of kids who are homeless. And I think we forget about them. They don't have digital access. We've not had contact with them. They're moving from hotel to hotel. And we've got to develop systems to be able to identify and find those kids. I'm sending social workers out. And I applaud my social workers. They put their masks on and they go find these kids. And they're keeping up with them. But that's not something that we're talking about, because we've got a whole segment of our population that through COVID, they become invisible. And if we're talking about social justice and we're talking about making sure that we're doing the right things morally, then it is our moral responsibility to make sure that the least of them are taken care of first. And I think while we argue about those things, about grades and who gets what, I want us to be arguing about what are we going to do for those kids that have become invisible as a result of the virus. Mm-hmm. And they'll pop back up on the scenes when everything's over. So, you know me, I will get started on the social justice.
I know. And this is why it's so great to have you here talking about that, because you're right. That's an issue that we don't discuss as much as we should. And Michael, I know that Cramden doesn't necessarily provide psychological support or social emotional support, but in order to take advantage of the things that Dr. Jackson just mentioned, telehealth and telecounseling, an adult needs to have some digital literacy skills. They need to understand how to use their device and their access to the internet for those purposes. And I know that Cramden has had in the past programs where they provide digital citizenship training for adults. And I want you to talk a little bit about those and how you've seen those benefit your relationships with the community.
Yeah, and I do want to echo Dr. Jackson's last point about homeless students. It's a topic nobody ever really discusses, and it's a horrifying problem to think about it, but it's something we all need to tackle. Because, you know, it could be as simple as, here's a Wi-Fi enabled laptop or tablet, you know, and that's what we need to get to them. And it's a very hard population to work with. In terms of what Cram's done in the past, anybody who works in the digital inclusion community, right, and that's what we call ourselves, digital inclusion practitioners. Digital inclusion is incredibly important because it's not just having the connectivity and the device and the relevance and how to use those things. It's also learning how to be a good digital citizen. And to be able to find those resources effectively and quickly and use them for what you need to be. So we've done lots of classes for adults, digital literacy classes. So we teach them not just how to use a computer, but also, hey, stay safe on the internet. Stay away from these websites, or this is how you figure out if this is something that's beneficial or true or not. And it's digital citizenship, right? It's being a good online citizen. I mean, it's, you know, I have two children, they're school-age students, and, you know, we get lots of teenage volunteers in here, and the internet is a swamp. It is an absolute swamp with no guidance, and it's frightening to me because especially some of our seniors, they've never grown up with devices or being online as much. And for them, it's a cause of anxiety and stress. And there is no more important time right now in the nation's history that I can think of for seniors to be more connected, but they're the most disconnected. Not just physically, because if you're in a nursing home, you can't see visitors. You know, they are by far the cohort that is the least connected of anybody. Anytime you slice a digital divide up, seniors are first and foremost. So it's anything we can do to enable them to get on the internet, to be, know how to use it, and use it in a way that they're comfortable with and that they can go through their goals. And these are, again, it's part and parcel of our mission. You know, the computer to us is just a means to an end. That end is for them to use whatever knowledge and resources they can have to better their life and their community. And it's, you know, it's something we see every single time. And it hurts me because right now we're not conducting any classes. Everything's on pause. And unfortunately, when you're talking about doing digital literacy classes, it is literally the butt in the seat has to be taught by an instructor. We can't give somebody a laptop and say, okay, we'll meet you on the Zoom meeting at 8 o'clock tonight. They're gonna look at me like I'm speaking Martian. They don't know what those words mean. You know, so we have to be there with instructors and teacher assistants to really hold their hands and make them as comfortable as possible. And that's the kind of work that we really want to keep doing as much as possible going forward.
Okay. And so given the circumstances both of you have just described, with the students who are currently invisible as a result of COVID, with the students who are currently not supported as well as they should be, and the challenges that our senior citizens are engaging, are interacting with currently with access and limitations in their ability to use the internet, where would you advise organizations or districts to start in terms of creating partnerships moving forward? Is there a type of organization or an area or a themed sort of partnership that they should start with first when we talk about moving forward with school and not going back to normal, but reimagining what school should be like? Where should they start?
So what I say often is our kids are going to need, we have a strong mentoring program in all of our schools where we connect them with adults in the community. But I think we're going to have to rethink how we do that. And I think we may even be able to expand that around e-mentors, where people learn to do it digitally, reach in just like we're doing right now. I think we're going to have to become comfortable being uncomfortable with this format of communicating with one another. And so as we do that, I want to encourage people, and it's so easy now, I can mentor 5-6 people.
Right.
Easily and just have conversations. I think we have to give kids portals and pathways to have good conversations about where they are, what they need, and what they're doing. I think we're also going to have people who are going to be role models in this work around partnering differently. No longer will partnering only mean that you come to the schools or that you give us something. Partnerships may well be that we are thought partners around solving problems only. That, you know, I listening to the work around the program in Cramden, I've thought about that a lot. And how do we give kids a touch point around these careers and opportunities that they ride by every day, and they have no clue what that really means. And so we've got to open those doors for them. And you can do that virtually. I think we're going to have to really, every organization out there is going to have to really talk about how can I, and I think you can expand my connection with kids and schools using the digital resources to really make sure that first kids are okay, that I've built relationships with them, but then also to expand their reach, most importantly. So.
And what about you, Michael? What would you advise community organizations in terms of reaching out to schools and districts about helping to solve some of the challenges that we just talked about?
It's a great question because you can approach it 1,000 different ways, right? For schools in my immediate periphery, so here in the Triangle, for example, you know, we have a lot of schools who are incredibly lucky in terms of the resources they have. But in the shadow of those schools are entire communities that don't have equal access to those resources. And to me, it's a marriage of resource and opportunity. And as Dr. Jackson said, I mean, there is there are more companies here doing tech, bio, incredible work in some of the highest fields in the world. And yet there are entire communities that don't have access to even knowing what the pathway to success is for those things. But North Carolina is luckier than most. You know, there are some great statewide organizations that only help with putting schools together with businesses so they can have a dialogue. For North Carolina Business Council on Education, for example, is one of them. You know, My Future NC is another. There are these great organizations that are stood up. Friday Institute has always been a fantastic facilitator of these relationships. Institute for Emerging Issues. So we are incredibly lucky in that sense. You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Schools don't have to start something from scratch. I guarantee you, if they're interested in a particular outcome, there is a project that's already existed out there that they can copy or mimic if they want to, and there are facilitators in place that are happy to do so. And schools should be, pardon the word, but greedy. They should want to see their exact goals and go get the partners that can help them achieve those exact goals. You know, and they should do that on behalf of the students. Students in our state, you know, and depending where you are, if it's a rural county, there are some incredible difficult challenges in rural counties. And they, you know, but there are resources in the state that can help them. And we just need to do a better job of cataloging these resources, acting as facilitators and interlocutors between them, and matchmaking. That is something that schools, I don't think, are inherently comfortable doing, is reaching outside their comfort zone. But they have to be uncomfortable. They have to be uncomfortable, and they have to be very loud and very consistent in what they want for their kids.
Absolutely. I want to take another opportunity to pause and encourage the audience to participate in the discussion online on Twitter using the hashtag #FutureReady. We're almost at the close here, but we definitely want to hear from you and your thoughts on community partnerships. Okay. And so based on what we've talked about, based on your experiences, we can see that schools are the center for connection and relationship building, that not only focus on students, but on the surrounding community, right? Students are definitely a pillar in the community. And as educators and supporters of public education, it's important that we work to strengthen those relationships. And as Michael just said, serve as matchmakers, right? To create positive impact for students and to develop their own ability to reach their full potential. As we close our conversation, I want you both to reflect on what we've talked about and a little bit about your experience with partnerships and offer some advice or resources or words of encouragement to education leaders and nonprofit leaders about creating and sustaining mutually beneficial partnerships between families, the school, and the surrounding community. So if you would, just take a second to think about what has helped you in your journey and what you would advise an educator or a nonprofit leader as we move through our current situation into what education will look like. What can you give them as a word of advice? And whoever is comfortable starting can go first.
I'll say a couple words before they flitter out of my mind. I would say approach this almost in either a military or political campaign, right? Figure out what your end goal is, figure out what you want to achieve with it, and then start bringing the stakeholders you need to achieve that goal. If it's something as easy, in my mind at least, as saying, hey, we need devices and kids, well, figure out what the resources are, and start saying, okay, this is the number we want to reach, et cetera. But if you're talking about something a little long-term, a specific educational goal, we want to make sure our kids are continuously learning in portals, you know, after school or during the weekends, or taking workshops on tech and STEAM and all sorts of issues so they can advance their career. Start thinking about the resources in your community, but start thinking about how you mobilize those resources. Think about what corporate funds or corporate resources you can bring to bear. Think about what the state can do. People forget about state government. State government is a fantastic interlocutor at all sorts of different levels. We're lucky in the state. We have Department of Public Instruction, which is a very strong department in the state, and they would be thrilled to know about a project that's going on in one part of the state so they can replicate that in another part of the state, so they can act as a facilitator. And again, some of the other organizations I mentioned earlier that are there specifically to look at programs that are successful and seeing how we can adapt those to other places where they can take them. So that's how I would kind of advise folks to do it. You know, be very methodical, be greedy about what you want to achieve, and then find those resources. They're not hidden. You can find them. Superintendents know this. They will ask each other. They will share resources. It's the exact same formula for success.
Awesome. Dr. Jackson, what about you?
Well, I would only say I want to challenge everyone to see this as a crisis, to see the time that we're in more as an opportunity to rethink, reimagine everything that we thought we knew about the work that we do every day. I want us to be open to embrace a notion that probably 50% of what we thought we knew was wrong, and the other 50% should be the catalyst to helping us create this new paradigm that will ultimately be beneficial for every single child. I am just a firm believer that out of this situation, we're going to be better, we're going to be stronger, we're going to be wiser, we're going to be an amazing opportunity for some kids who we've missed over time, that we're going to create those kinds of entities. I think for our teachers, I want to say this is the opportunity to do all those things you always thought were crazy around teaching kids and meeting kids at the point of their need, because now we're no longer locked into having to teach a full room of kids every 5 minutes. You can individually meet the needs of every single one of your children, and you can build the space to do it for them. So don't be afraid of that. And I don't want us to be afraid of what every day I thank COVID-19 for the opportunity. I really do. I start my day by saying thank you for the opportunity. Because at the end of the day, for me, I'm hoping that the emergency will create urgency for all of us to do things differently. Because if we go back and recreate and just turn the button and start up what we left on March 13th, and what was all of this for? I think every storm comes to help us create new pathways and to, in some ways, to clear paths for us. And so let this be a refining fire for us and not a consuming fire. I want it to be a refiner for us, make us stronger, make us better as we kind of move forward. And I'm just hoping that people will see it for the opportunity that it is and just take advantage of it and be willing to fail and gracefully fail and keep moving. That's all we can do. So,
absolutely. Thank you both for those really awesome words of encouragement. I can't tell you enough how wonderful it is to hear from passionate leaders like you who are invested and heavily vested in your communities and work every day to push the needle as to what you can do better. I want to remind our viewers that information about Future Ready is available at futureready.org. We encourage and challenge district leaders across the country to join our over 3,500 others to sign our pledge and commit themselves and their district to student-centered learning. I also want to encourage our viewers to tune into our podcast series, Leading Through Unprecedented Times, to hear from other education leaders from across the country about their successes and challenges with implemented student-centered learning. As always, we are actively working to provide you with more relevant, practical, and up-to-date resources, so please stay engaged. Thank you so much, Michael Abensor and Dr. Anthony Jackson. You are both a pleasure to talk with today, and I look forward to other opportunities to engage with both of you. Don't forget to connect with us on Twitter at FutureReady and at facebook.com/FutureReadySchools. If you missed it today, we missed you, but you can watch an archived recording of the webinar at futureready.org/webinars. Thank you again for joining us. I really appreciate it, and stay safe and have a great day.